Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC and Bob Henley from WNYC News is at the Democratic Convention with the cloud of scandal descending on the New York delegation and with some post-Tampa thoughts about whether Governor Christie was a convention belly flop, as the Times poked fun of him as, or gave the me note address, as some have also been quoted saying. We'll talk about both conventions. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
But to the Democrats first, because pretty much there's breaking news in Charlotte. The Democrats in the New York delegation have their own problems with the secret payoff to the sexual harassment victims of Assemblyman Vito Lopez hanging over their heads. You just came from the delegation breakfast. We're going to play a clip of tape in a minute of you with Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver. But how heavy was the Lopez tainted air?
I think that it pretty much dominates. There's a number of issues that have to be unpacked. You have D.A. Hynes appropriately recused himself. Republican Dan Donovan from Staten Island is actually doing a criminal probe because it may be that some of Lopez's alleged actions crossed the line. The question here is, of course, there were an initial round of complainants that came forward that gave the Assembly notice they were going to sue. At issue here is a decision by the Speaker to keep that some $100,000 payment, I guess Lopez threw in some $30,000, keep that confidential and secret, and at the same time not referring it to the ethics panel. You know, you have to ask yourself a central question, is this enabling behavior? And I did catch up with the Speaker and asked him that.
I may know a hell of a lot more than you. Because when you were 14, passing the Farm Labor Bill.
Yeah.
I was passing protections in California.
We'll get back to Jerry Brown in a minute, I promise.
Yeah.
But here's a little bit of Bob's interview with Sheldon Silver just a few minutes ago at the Democratic Convention in Charlotte.
Do you feel, looking back, that this might look like enabling behavior in terms of what happened because of this, the covert payment and not referring it to the ethics panel?
No, I don't think that's fair. I think what really happened here, and I, you know, will readily say we made mistakes along the way, and the confidentiality was a mistake, and the fact that the ethics panel did not do the investigation was a mistake. But what happened here is the people who made the decisions, and me ultimately responsible for, felt that they were doing what was best interest of the victims here. And the victims did not express the desire not to come forward in that regard. And one of the things we are very, very cautious about is to make sure that the way this is treated will never be construed by somebody who has a problem that they will be reluctant to come forward to the appropriate place.
But, Bob, what I still don't get after that answer is why didn't they just go public with just the existence of the investigation from the get-go? They certainly didn't have to release the victims' names, but Lopez was going to be toast in any case once they announced the finding of sexual harassment. What or who were Silver and the others protecting?
Well, there were two rounds. There was the initial response that was, and in this case, what's a little disconcerting is that the Attorney General's office at some mid-level management had a look at the confidentiality agreement. The controller's office signed off on the payment. What we have here is the difficulty of balancing competing interests and institutional interests. As the Speaker laid out, the Assembly is an employer. On the other hand, when conduct, even if it's referred to through a potential whistleblower or through an employment harassment case, if you get some kind of evidence as an employer that there could be criminal behavior, there's an affirmative obligation, I think people would argue, to do that criminal referral. It has its own life because advocates could argue that they set the stage for Lopez to continue doing this behavior because he had gotten away with it once before.
So how much does this rub off on State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman?
Well, I think it's not so much that it rubs off on them, but it raises a question. I just had a conversation with Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. This raises a much broader question about what's going on through the state of New York Because remember, the state of New York is an employer. And I asked the controller, do you have any sense of how many payments have been made for hostile work environments throughout the entire bureaucracy? And he didn't have an answer, because often this would appear and be masked only as a payment to a lawyer. So indeed, I think this is going to end as well. It should engender a much broader conversation about the state of New York really becoming a model workplace affirmatively when it comes to these kinds of balancing these competing issues.
I read that Schneiderman denied approving the secret payouts. Then it emerged that Silver had at least consulted with him. What do you know to be true?
Well, to be fair to Schneiderman's office, they put all the emails out there. What it was is consulting over the boilerplate language that was in the statement. They had no capacity. Again, this was an arbitration agreement reached between the parties. There was an initial request for $1.2 million, so people thought it was in the public policy interest, if you will, to resolve it for this much lower number. But the central question, and we'll see later today if the Joint Commission on Public Ethics takes this up, and again, that's a new wrinkle here. This is something that Governor Andrew Cuomo signed into law. This is going to be unusual in the sense that historically, as we've seen, the Assembly and State Senate washed or did not wash their ethical laundry themselves. Now they're going to be put through a spin drive by JCOP. And then also, as I said before, there's this parallel track criminal investigation by D.A. Donovan.
JCOP, the Joint Committee on Public Ethics. WNYC's Bob Henley with us at the Democratic Convention in Charlotte. We can take your phone calls, folks, for a few minutes for Bob, either on this whole Vito Lopez Plus scandal at this point, 212-433-WNYC. Questions, if there are things about it you don't understand, or comments, if you want to vent, 212-433-WNYC, or on how Chris Christie did ultimately as potential presidential fodder, maybe someday, at the Republican convention, which we'll get to, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Bob, before we get to Christie, you reported earlier that this distracts, this whole Vito Lopez, et cetera thing, distracts from some sources of pride that the New York delegation would rather be focusing on. Like what?
Well, certainly this is going to be the convention at which the Democratic Party adopts as part of its platform gay marriage. And the feeling of the delegation here is that this was really burnished New York's credentials as the progressive leader, as they see it in the nation. They believe that it was that move, bipartisan, quarterbacked by Governor Cuomo, that really set the stage for President Barack Obama to move on it. They even go so far as to say that they think this is a winning strategy. I mean, it's important to get some local context here. North Carolina, the president only carried it in 2008 by some 20,000 votes. In 2010, the Republicans came roaring back, much like they did in New Jersey, captured both state houses, the upper and lower houses, first time they did that since the 1890s. And the you're seeing here Yetta Curlin, Tom Duane's state senator, Tom Duane, saying, listen, let's come down here and, you know, make this an issue. I mean, I'm sure that, the, you know, their analysis would be there's at least 20,000 people who are gay who'd like to get married in North Carolina. So they see this as actually a counter swing state strategy.
That's very different from in 2004, where opposing gay marriage in a ballot referendum helped President Bush win Ohio and therefore the election. But it's a little harder to argue that you're the party of sexual progressivism and equality and then have your all-white male hetero leadership commit and badly handle the inquiry into sexual harassment of young women.
Are you looking for coherence, Brian?
My vain quest for coherence. Let's talk about Governor Christie. How are the reviews in Tampa? Mixed, right?
Well, no. I mean, you have to understand, I was in the loving circle of the Jersey delegation, which took over entirely the Serrata Resort. So it wasn't an internment camp, but I'm just saying this was folks of like mind. I think that the party faithful on the floor were thrilled. I think that certainly the media, you know, made much of his approach. Again, I know that we have a predilection for 2016. Right now, I've said this before, Governor Christie's job, as he sees it, as co-chair of the Republican Governors Association, is to continue to gobble up America's state houses. That's why there's 29 Republican governors now, more than 20 of them since 2010. They have 20 state houses where they control both the upper and lower house and the governor, compared to 11 for New Jersey. So we can talk about hypotheticals about 2016. Meanwhile, they continue to lay the groundwork for, as they see it, a fundamental shift in American politics.
And Christie has to get reelected next year, assuming he's interested in that. But what's this rumbling then about a Mean-Ode address? Now, I wasn't in Tampa. I read this in the New York Times over the weekend, but apparently, some party officials thought it was too much about him and not about Romney, or his speech was street tough in a Christie kind of way. But if part of the goal was to make him look like a serious contender for 2016, it just wasn't necessarily a presidential speech.
Well, I guess the thing is that, A, it wasn't a presidential speech. Did he hold the room, which he did, whatever you think about what he had to say? And quite frankly, Clint Eastwood's performance eclipsed it all.
Yeah, but unlike Clint Eastwood, Christie seemed to go around ready to pick a fight with any occupied chair. The Times article, which wound up in Sunday Styles for some reason, gave several examples. And here is the one that's gotten some national attention. After the keynote speech, Christie addressed on another occasion the California Republican delegation and jabbed at 74-year-old Democratic Governor Jerry Brown like this.
California made a bad choice by going with an old retread who, let me tell you this, I cannot believe you people elected Jerry Brown over Meg Whitman. He won the New Jersey presidential primary over Jimmy Carter when I was 14 years old.
He's so old, I can't believe it. And now, wait a minute.
I recorded that tape. Yeah, that was there.
So that prompted this retort from Governor Brown in Sacramento, who said he recently ran 3 miles in 29 minutes.
I may know a hell of a lot more than you, because when you were 14, I was passing the farm labor bill. I was passing worker protections in California. And I hereby challenge Governor Christie to a 3-mile race, a push-up contest, and a chin-up contest, and whatever he wants to bet, I have no doubt of the outcome.
Chin-ups. Bob Christie never wants to get into a spitting match with someone about their physical attributes, I would think, but he managed to do it. And so
I think the politicians, both guys win in this. Both narrative stands up. I mean, I think in that sense they've created a narrative, and here we are talking about it. So
you don't think it didn't embarrass Republican Party officials when that exchange went national? They consider it an image booster for getting in Jerry Brown's face that way?
I don't think they're really concerned about what the New York Times has to say about Chris Christie.
It's not just the New York Times. That was played all over the country. Google has played on every local television station.
I think the issue here is that Chris Christie has his brand. He only increased his power, and he will have a full dance card to go wherever he wants to campaign for anybody. No one's saying, oh, gosh, Jerry Brown said something challenged him to pull-ups. I don't think it works that way.
212-433-WNYC. John in Paramus. You're on the air. Hi, John.
Yeah, you know what he did, Christie? He went middle of the road. He didn't want to be too controversial in the national speech, but he wanted to sell himself as someone who was determined. He didn't want to ruffle any feathers, and he didn't give the usual bombastic speech that he does to the rest of New Jersey.
Thank you, Bob. He did tone it down a little bit in the speech. Did you hear it as middle of the road in the same way as John?
Well, it's a change of format. When he has to be guided by a script, he can't indulge himself in the same rhetorical excesses, which I think sometimes he regrets. So it was a discipline of the forum. I think also that he did leave some money on the table in the sense we put a lot of energy into talking about what had happened with education and the teachers union, but he never, at least to my ear, circled back and explained his concern and delineated for people that he supports and praises suburban public schools, but has made a focus, much like President Obama has, on New Jersey's failing urban schools. And I think he failed to connect on that.
212-433-WNYC. Robert in Manhattan, you're on the air. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Brian. You know, one thing that has to be emphasized about the settlement that Speaker Silva did is, if the reports are accurate, it's $130,000 from state treasury versus allegedly a demand of $1 million-plus, maybe more. That's not a bad settlement for the state, given the magnitude of the allegations, the civil allegations, against Assemblyman Lopez. Second, I mean, there's another side to this story. I think Gloria Allred represented some of the prospective plaintiffs. She's a very, very aggressive and competent attorney. They were well represented, it sounds like. They made a calculated decision to settle. And so I think we're losing sight a little bit. I know there's politics, and I know there's the issue of confidentiality and transparency. But just in terms of benefiting the state, in terms of the settlement, that's not a bad settlement. So Speaker Silver, on the substance, the comptroller and the attorney general, at least to the extent they had access, made a decision as, I think, competent lawyers and parties. This is not a bad deal, given the magnitude of the allegation.
But Brian, may I ask this caller a question? I mean, the key thing here is, I think your point's well taken as far as the process of plaintiff litigation. But is there, what happens if what is alleged there crosses over as criminal behavior potentially, and is there an affirmative obligation of an employer to, as we say, see something, say something, and report it to Dave, wherever it occurred, whatever DA would have been relevant?
Here's my view of that. Now, of course, facts are very important, and it's off the top of my head, and I'm not representing anybody in this. But as an attorney, my view would be no. Now, it may be that Speaker Silver and the Attorney General and the Comptroller have public obligations. It's a little bit different. What were their public obligations?
That's the biggest issue about the secret settlement, right?
I think, well, not a secret settlement, but rather the facts of what the allegations were. Did they have, remember, their allegations in a settlement, nobody admits anything, presumably, mm-hmm. other than obviously the fact that he settled, he didn't fight it, he didn't say I'm innocent.
Right.
So it strikes me we have to look at the laws that govern these public officials, given the nature of the allegations. One, did they have to disclose? And two, how did they have to disclose? The timing and all of that. But as to the criminal aspect, no, I think that he's still liable. He, you know, he's going to be under criminal investigation, Lopez. So I don't think that issue is the issue. The issue is more of, I don't want to say politics, but public ethics and disclosure, timing and that type of thing.
Right. Well, that's why Silver is now in hot water. But Robert, before you go, as an attorney and knowing the context of your many calls to the show on the progressive side of many issues, do I hear you questioning the veracity of these women's claims because they settled for only $100,000 when they asked for $1 million?
No, because in the nature of these type of allegations, this is a calculus. I'm assuming their attorneys advised them and they weighed all of the issues of a public trial, whether it's someone like Lopez and all the public officials or even not. It's quite a emotionally racking situation. I have represented some employees in my practice. So, I remember it was done pretty quickly in terms of the settlement, it sounds like. I mean, Bob would know this better, but it strikes me that did this take 6 months to maybe less in terms of demand letter to settlement? I'm not sure, but it strikes me that, no, I'm not criticizing those prospective plaintiffs. They made a decision with their counsel.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, I hear you. Robert, thank you very much. Let me jump right to Susan in Westfield. Susan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Well, hello. I'm thrilled to be responding to your topic here. My name is Susan. I'm from Westfield, New Jersey. I am a cradle Democrat. I come from a town where it is probably the Republican gathering place in the state, and I know personally some of the Republican leaders in our state, and they do gather here.
Does cradle Democrat mean you were kind of born into Democratic family?
Yes, I was born into a Democratic family. In fact, one of my grandfathers was a labor leader in Philadelphia during the Depression. So that gives you a little bit of background about me. When Governor Christie was elected, I wasn't too sure. I'm grateful now that he has been our governor and that he has been changing the runaway train issues in the state. I believe that the Democratic Party in the state was out of control and giving too many things away. Governor Christie has stepped up to the plate. He is not afraid to confront the labor unions and the power people in the state, and he has put the brakes on. He has put a 2% cap on the municipal taxes that they're allowed to charge us. My husband and I would be considered upper middle class, and we are struggling. We are struggling very much.
Under the weight of the property taxes.
Yeah, for the property taxes and just costs of living and insurances, et cetera, et cetera.
Susan, I got to go here in a second, but I'm curious if as a kind of Christie Democrat, you're also considering Romney this year.
Never. Never. I would never go back. We cannot go back, and I'm very fearful. I'll say the all-white male club or mostly white male club and the corporations that have pumped their money into both campaigners. I'm very fearful, and especially in this state with Governor Christie, that he may not go forward and then he may give in to corporate pressure. And
Susan, I'm going to leave it there. That's so fascinating, though, Bob, and we have just 1 minute left. And Susan, please call us again. But Bob, a Christie Obama voter, passionate on both sides.
Yeah, and there are. I mean, that's what was amazing. From 2008 to 2009, Christie moved tens of thousands of folks like that. I will also say just about the property tax, there is some pushback going on that the taxes have continued to go up. And the underlying problem here is that people's home values have declined while the property taxes have continued to go up. And that is unsustainable.
WNYC's Bob Henley in Charlotte. Talk to you later in the week.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the Sunlight Foundation crashes the parties, literally, of the biggest interest group donors in Tampa and Charlotte to follow the backroom drinks and hors d'oeuvres money trail. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and outside the Republican and Democratic convention halls, it turns out some of the real politicking is taking place away from the cameras, the delegates, and some of the host city's most premier venues. Joining me to pull the curtain on the convention, so to speak, is Liz Bartolomeo, communications manager and convention blogger for the Sunlight Foundation, which tries to shed sunlight on the money and other workings of politics in both parties. She joins us from Charlotte. Hi, Liz.
Hi there.
Your organization has classified these conventions as three-tiered pyramids. What do you mean?
Well, this is something that kind of came up when we were in Tampa last week for the Republican National Convention. It's about sort of the haves and the have-nots in terms of access. Everyone is in these conventions to, you know, recognize that they're excited to nominate their nominee for president, whether it be Barack Obama or Mitt Romney. But one thing that became very, very clear at the Republican convention was this three-tiered system. At the bottom, you had the delegates where they kind of went to their delegation events. They might have their member of Congress speaking there. They might have their governor speaking there, but they were really kind of there just to celebrate being Republicans, really like just wanting to have this experience for themselves. You know, they were able to go into anything they wanted to do within their state delegation. On the middle level was some of the more access-needed events being thrown by lobbying groups, special interest groups. They might be morning breakfasts. They might be cocktail receptions. Oftentimes, there were influence makers there. There were members of Congress. There were strategists. Be able to get a lot of good face time with these more sort of high-level events. And at the very top of our convention pyramid was the super PAC donors, the Romney bundlers, these millionaires who have given, you know, thousands of dollars, millions of dollars to support Republican candidates and their super PACs and other outside groups. They got the most exclusive access to the tastemakers within the party. Here in Charlotte, it's proving to be a little similar. You know, myself and my colleague who are out here on the party circuit looking at the influence here in Charlotte are sort of seeing this emerge already.
So tell me about some of these parties. Start with Tampa, because you were there kind of going from party to party, figuring out who is eating what and who is giving what in pursuit of what special interest, right?
Exactly. One thing that became sort of the buzz around Tampa is, when will the super PAC donors come up? Is Bob Perry going to be there? Is Jerry Parenchio going to be there? Will Sheldon Adelson and his wife, Dr. Miriam Adelson, will be there? We quickly found out that the Adelsons were in town. And, you know, our reporter identified that they could very well show up at a group at a sort of mid-level, this middle tier access reception for the Jewish Republican Coalition. And what our reporter, Keenan Steiner, did is he went to that event, showed up. There was a throng of media there, and you know, sure enough, the Adelsons did show up. Why do they show up? Well, not only do they support, are they a pro-Israel, they like pro-Israel causes, but one thing they were really looking at too is they had given, the Adelsons have given to this RJC group.
On another realm, in sort of another realm of political spending, there was a huge Marco Rubio event in Tampa that I read had Microsoft behind it. What was that about?
That's correct. That was one of the first early nights in Tampa. It was called Nuestra Noche, and it was, you know, to celebrate Hispanic leaders in the Republican Party. There was a live salsa band. There was an open bar. It was in an old store, like mansion in the Ybor City area. And about, you know, halfway through the party, out comes Senator Rubio trying to engage the crowd, get people excited to be there for the nominating convention in Tampa. You know, sort of there, we kind of found out what was happening throughout the evening. That event, it did have a VIP section. It did have other tastemakers within the Republican Party there. Jeb Bush was there earlier. I believe one of the Romney sons was there earlier talking to the crowd and making an appearance. But, you know, we thought there would be a lot of pushback. But in terms of getting media access and, like, myself and my colleague, blogger access, they were really open to having us being there.
So what does Microsoft get from throwing money at a Marco Rubio party? It's clear what Sheldon Adelson gets. He's pretty transparent about wanting certain conservative policies with respect to the Middle East and wanting enabling legislation regarding casinos, which is what he makes his money from. What does Microsoft want with a Marco Rubio party?
You know, what Microsoft gets and what these other corporate donors get for these events is they get their name out there. They're going to get their name on the signage. They're going to be able to send representatives from their company or their lobbyists to these events to talk to the people there, to talk to the politicians in events, to politicians at these events, to talk to any other sort of lawmakers, decision makers there at these convention events to say, like, hey, I'm here with Microsoft. What are you working on? That sort of, you know, conversation that happens a lot within Washington is happening at these conventions. This is one of only four times a year where you have lots of people working within the political process in one city for 4 days with really not much to do. Yes, we have over 400 events for this week on Party Time, but it's able to get your message out there, your interest out there in a very short, concentrated period of time.
So what parties are you attending or keeping your eye on in Charlotte?
We're keeping on quite a bit. We know we can't get to all of them. There's something happening morning, noon, and night. Some things are happening in the city. Some things are happening out in golf courses. Some things are happening on lakes. But we're keeping an eye on sort of this more mid-level and upper-tier access events. One thing that's really caught our attention is three of the biggest Democratic super PACs, Priorities USA Action, House Majority, and Majority PAC, are holding what they're calling a Super-O-Rama. And they're having three events that we know of via Sunlight's Party Time site, a breakfast, a policy briefing reception this afternoon, and a giant kind of concert party after President Obama's speech on Thursday night. These groups, they put out a fundraising packet suggesting donation between $25,000 and $100,000. But these super PACs can accept unlimited contributions. So there's very good chance some of their millionaire donors might be giving another $1 million to attend some of these events.
Unlimited contributions and also anonymous contributions?
Not for super PACs. Super PACs, if an individual, if an organization, if a company gives to the, or a union gives to a super PAC, they do disclose their donation with the Federal Election Commission. Most of them are on a monthly basis. Some of them we don't only know four times a year. And that information Sunlight Foundation tracks on our Follow the Unlimited Money website. But if it is a issue group, a 501c4, a nonprofit gives to one of these super PACs, we don't know who is the donor behind the nonprofit, because for many nonprofits, they do not disclose who gives them money.
So As far as you could tell, are any lines being crossed here with the money flowing into these parties? Are any rules or laws being broken or campaign finance laws being skirted because this isn't technically campaign finance?
It's something we're keeping an eye on, but we have not seen anything that threw up a big red flag right now. You know, as myself and my colleague, you know, as we attend these events, keep track of sort of who is there, what is happening, we are seeing is the toothpick rule in effect. That is an outside of the House Ethics Guidelines being changed in 2007, where if a member of Congress is in attendance, they cannot have a seated dinner if the event is being thrown by a lobbyist. The toothpick rule, with the party I was at last night for the Democratic Governors Association, seemed to be in full effect. I had lots of little fried arancini rice bulbs. That was pretty one of the foods they were passing around.
All right. What's the best hors d'oeuvre you've tasted in a week and a half of convention eating?
I had a really good mushroom flatbread pizza last night, a little slice of it.
And who paid for your mushroom flatbread pizza?
Whoever sponsored the Democratic Governors Association event. They have over 15 sponsors listed among their events so far.
And among the corporations sponsoring these events, we should point out, there are some that are holding events at both conventions. How do you explain that, and what are some of those?
You know, some groups include the Financial Services Roundtable. Others include the space industry. They're having some Space Jam events. There is the United States Conference of Mayors, and some arts groups are having some arts policy forums. You know, these groups, they have interests with both parties. They have interests within Washington. It might be they want to get their message out to both the delegates here, the influencers here, and it looks like they also might have the money to be able to throw on events to both of these and both of these cities.
Well, I guess if you're going to run a special interest group, you might as well get your hooks into both parties if you think you can influence the eventual winner from either, right?
Exactly.
Well, Liz Bartolomeo, communications manager and convention blogger for the Sunlight Foundation. I guess if you're going to work for a wonkish good government group, you might as well be on the party's beat, right?
It's getting a lot of less sleep than usual, though.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now a call-in for women on how you weigh reproductive rights against other issues when choosing a candidate for president. Both campaigns, of course, are trying hard to maximize the number of women voters. There are these analyses about the gender gap. If Obama gets X percent more women than Romney does in certain key states like Ohio, very much in the spotlight for the gender gap vote, then he's likely to win the state and therefore the election. If he gets just a few points less, like I think in Ohio, the gap, the range is somewhere between 10% better than Romney or 13% better than Romney. And that little difference might be the difference in Ohio, and Ohio might be the difference in the election. That's one of the reasons we're seeing so much focus at both conventions on women, and particularly certain demographic groups of women who are considered swing voters. So much of Ann Romney's speech last week was designed to make women feel that she as First Lady would be a voice for them, even if her husband doesn't seem relatable.
I'm not sure if men really understand this, but I don't think there's a woman in America who really expects her life to be easy. In our own ways, we all know better. You know what? And that's fine. We don't want easy. But the last few years have been harder than they needed to be.
Ann Romney. And on Sunday's Meet the Press, Carly Fiorina, former CEO of HP and former Republican candidate for U.S. Senate from California, tried to take the focus off of Paul Ryan's support for an abortion ban with no exception for rape this way.
As a woman, it makes me sad that we continue to treat women as a special interest group. Women are over half of the population. They are not single issue voters. I know that people feel very strongly about abortion and abortion rights, but to try and pigeonhole women, which I think, frankly, the Democratic Party continues to milk this issue and manipulate women as single issue voters and say all you care about is abortion, whatever their views are on abortion, women care about every issue.
Carly Fiorina backing the Republican ticket on Meet the Press by arguing, as you heard, that the Democrats and the press have too narrow a view of what a woman's issue is. And so I thought we would take some time on this convention day to open the phones on that right now. We'll see how Michelle Obama deals with it in her speech tonight. But let's do a call in for women right now, Democratic women, Republican women, independent women. 212-433-WNYC is the number to call, 212-433-9692. And the question, as Fiorina frames it, is really how do you weigh reproductive rights against other issues when choosing a candidate for president? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Or another way to ask it, how do you decide who to vote for based on what you see as women's issues? 212-433-9692. So Republican women, what are women's issues to you? Any pro-choice Republican women listening? How do you reconcile that given the party's record and platform on that issue, you still want to vote for a Republican? 212-433-9692. Democratic women, what are women's issues to you? Do you ever think Republicans might be better for the economy or foreign policy or national security? But you go, oh my God, I can't break out of these reproductive rights issues because I feel so strongly about how they're framing them. So we'll save some lines for each of you, Democrats and Republicans. And independents, you are welcome to 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. A call in for women on how you weigh reproductive rights against other issues when choosing a candidate for president and your responses to those Ann Romney and Carly Fiorina clips. Give us a call. WNYC. Our lines are full with women who want to answer the question, how do you weigh reproductive rights against other issues when choosing a candidate for president? If you want to get in on our comments page, of course, unlimited space there at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Elizabeth in Summers, New York, you're on WNYC. How's Northern Westchester today?
It's great. Thank you.
What's up?
I called in. I was listening to the radio, and I just find it infuriating that the Republican Party tries to minimize how important this one issue can be to women, and it's not being a single item voter. It's smart women considering education and the environment and so many other factors. However, when you go to pull that lever, it's hard to forget that I am a woman and I have a daughter and we need options. And when I see people so far to the right who believe that, God forbid, my daughter were raped and got pregnant, that this man would even have rights to the child, it's hard not to keep that one issue in the forefront when we're voting.
And are you in a place where you might consider voting for Republican candidates sometimes if they're pro-choice because you feel like, you know, sometimes there may be some equal weight on economic or other issues, or you're just
absolutely
a diehard Democrat?
I consider myself a Democrat. I'm socially quite liberal. However, I consider myself open-minded, and I'm willing to have discussion. And if I agree with much of what a Republican were saying and could really help the economy and the education, I'm a teacher, a special ed teacher, then I'd be happy to vote for one. But I absolutely cannot do it when I'm thinking about the daughters and the next generation.
Elizabeth, thank you for your call. Martha in Highland Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Martha.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The first issue I look at is abortion rights. If the candidate is not pro-abortion, I won't take a second look at all. I've got two daughters, one of whom had a child between the ages of 35 and 40. And when she became pregnant that second time, she called and said, Mom, I'm going to have an amniocentesis. If there's a problem, I'm going to have an abortion. Is that okay with you? And I said, absolutely.
So, you, right. So you've been through a personal...
I was pregnant with my younger daughter at age 39. I had an amniocentesis, and my husband and I had decided that if Down syndrome was coming up, then I was going to have an abortion. I could not cope with that.
So it's a deal breaker. Do you vote
absolutely
for Republicans otherwise sometimes?
No. I haven't found a Republican yet who is as open-minded to the rest of the world as I am.
Martha, thank you for your call. Now, we are going to save some lines for Republican women who are not calling in yet as much as the Democratic women. Obviously, there's a very strong feeling about this. And in this part of the country, it's very, very predominant. So what about some of you who are Republican women? 212-433-WNYC. I mean, in New York State, for example, no Republican, almost no Republican, runs for statewide office unless they're pro-choice. That's part of how Pataki was picked to run for governor against Mario Cuomo in 1994, and he won three terms. If he was anti-choice, then maybe he wouldn't have won election against Cuomo. So that's in this part of the country, you know, the opinions are pretty strong and pretty to one side. So how about Republican women? Do you vote? Do you sometimes vote for Republicans despite being pro-choice, if you are pro-choice? Or does it not matter, which is the point that Carly Fiorina was trying to make, even if you are pro-choice and a Republican candidate who you support on other issues, the economy, war, whatever, national security, lines up better with you? Does abortion not become a deal breaker or other reproductive rights? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Seema in Somerset, you're on the air. Hi, Seema.
Yes, hi, Brian. My thing is this. I'm a Hindu, and what I feel that the Republican Party is promoting is basically they're trying to force their Catholic values on the rest of the country, which I oppose. You know, different religions have different norms for this. And the other thing is that it's hypocritical when you say you don't want government intrusion, and this is the most personal intrusion I can think of.
Is there a sort of Hindu position on abortion? Does it come up one way or another?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, I don't think, and I think, you know, in India, one of the ways of family planning or birth control is through abortion, and I think it's, you know, practiced over there. So I assume that there's not any traditional position on abortions.
Thank you very much. Miranda in West Islip, you're on WNYC. Hi, Miranda.
Hi. I just wanted to also tell you that I really love your show.
Thank you.
This is my first year of voting. I just turned 18 in the spring.
Congratulations.
And, yeah, thank you. And pro-life support is absolutely 100% a deal breaker for me. And I'm proud to say that. And I'm proud to say that in this case, I am kind of a single issue voter. I'm a woman, and I can't respect myself and vote against my own freedom and self-interest like that in an election. It's just something that I can't do. But on the other hand, I am also a Democrat, and I support the Democratic positions on most of the other issues. So it's never actually an internal struggle for me to vote Democrat as opposed to vote Republican on this issue.
Right. At least not yet before you've cast your first vote. let me ask you something. As somebody who's going to vote for the first time, and, you know, I guess you're a few years behind people who really got lit up by Obama hope and change four years ago, or maybe you were also, you know, really into it when you were 14. Do you talk to people who are just a little bit older than you and who were getting so enthusiastic in 2008, and are they not anymore?
I mean, in my household, yeah, I was very, you know, my mom is very politically active, so I was very aware of everything that was going on in 2008. So, like, even in my own household, there is some disappointment. There's definitely been a little bit of a letdown with Obama, but we are still big supporters, perhaps not as enthusiastic as we were in 2008. Enthusiastic is the wrong word. We're not as hopeful as we were in 2008, but we are still big supporters just because he hasn't done a terrible job and he's so much better than the alternate.
It's stop the Republicans time.
Yeah.
Miranda, thank you very much. Let's go to Trish. And good luck. Congratulations on voting.
Thank you.
Report back after Election Day. Trish in Norwalk, you're on WNYC. Hi, Trish.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I have voted both ways. I have voted for Republican and I have voted for Democrat, mostly based on what they present. The abortion thing does make or break it because if they get involved with abortion and we open up the abortion rulings again, are we going to start diving into fertility and in vitro and then deciding how many embryos we're going to put in people if they want to have children? And then if they want to freeze embryos, will they be forced to freeze embryos because then they have to save lives? So I think it's a bigger picture than even just abortion.
There's a very contested Senate race in Connecticut with Chris Murphy, who I expect that we're going to have on, by the way, during the Democratic Convention week, and Linda McMahon, who he had on the other week. What's her position on reproductive rights? Do you know?
What's Linda's position?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I do not know.
Do not know.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was just curious. But it sounds like you would tend toward the Democrats in general, yes?
Yeah, I mean, we've gone through a lot of things, and I would have hated to have the government or someone just decide what my husband and I would have chosen to do.
Trish,
that's a personal thing.
Thank you so much. And since I raised the question, and I should know the answer, so we will check on that and let you know. Linda McMahon's, I presume Chris Murphy is pro-choice. We'll find out Linda McMahon's position. Eileen in West Orange on WNYC. Hi, Eileen.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks for calling.
I'm a Republican, and I'm definitely pro-life. I'm Catholic. But at the same time, I don't just say, oh, I'm going to vote Republican. I look at what their economic issues and other issues are that are going to support the women that they say they don't want to have an abortion. It's not just enough to say I'm pro-life. You have to do it and look at it from an economic and education standpoint.
Did caller earlier who said, how can the Republicans say they're for getting government off people's backs in general, then turn around and say, we're going to legislate this most personal moral decision that an individual woman could make? When you say you're pro-life, how does that argument strike you?
Well, I think that you can look at it as the decision that is most intimate for a woman. But when it comes right down to it, I have to look also at the life of that abortion would end. So that's why I look at it that way. But again, you have to support the woman and her baby for the next 18 years. Those economic policies that I see the Republican Party trying to bring out now give me a lot of concern, a whole lot of concern, actually.
So have you decided between Romney and Obama for yourself?
I actually have. I'm going to have to vote for Obama this time.
Huh. So in your case, economic policies and compassion, it sounds like, trump your pro-life stance.
Right, because without those economic policies, we have no chance of saving babies because mothers can't afford to have those children.
Thank you for your call. I appreciate it. D in Brooklyn, we've only got a sound bite's worth of time left in the show. You got 20 seconds and it's all yours.
All right. I switched my party affiliation to Republican this year. And on this pro-life issue or pro-choice issue, rather, personally, it's not for me. But I do think that women need to equate this as there's a point where they're getting hysterical and also screaming to be the only ones legislating it. It affects society and, like, nowhere else where it's civilized is it, like, so accepted to just go on about this. And there's so many forms of birth control which can deter it from the optional state that I just think it's just like hysterics over the economy.
Dee, thank you very much for your call. Thanks to all of you for calling. Linda McMahon's position, we looked it up. Pro-choice. She says, however, I oppose partial birth abortion and federal funding of abortions unless the life of the mother is at stake. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Talk to you tonight at 7 for our mostly swing states pre-convention call-in.